So, welcome everyone. Can everyone hear me? Yes? Good. So, again, welcome. Again, because I come to give a Dharma talk here only once a month now, I always want to make sure that there's plenty of time for questions. Because that's really most important, that people really have their questions about life and their practice and how they apply their practice to life and life to their practice and all that, that everything is very clear. And that in one's readings and study of the various teachings, that they're again clearly understood, and most importantly, one knows how to apply them in a meaningful, effective way in one's life. Again, when we read teachings or we hear a Dharma talk, oftentimes we are hearing generic teachings. But how to specifically apply them to our own situations is not often clear, and that is the role of a teacher, of a mentor, to help that process. So, good. So, does anybody have any questions, simple or complex? Yes, Pauline.
The question that came to my mind is that I noticed that some of the areas of my life I'm very patient.
Can you just speak up a little bit?
Yes. I noticed that in some areas of my life I'm very patient, mm-hmm. In some areas I'm very impatient. Mm-hmm. I kind of find that interesting because you would think if you could get it in one area, you would be able to easily apply it in the other area.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could.
So let me just repeat that question. So Pauline is saying, in a kind of observing herself in life, she has observed that in some situations or in her life, she demonstrates a wonderful practice of patience. And then she has noted in other areas of life, she demonstrates a fairly miserable capacity for patience, and she's going, hey, what's this about, right? Why is it if I can be so patient over here, why not over there? And again, I think that is our nature, of what we bring to the practice, which is we all have a uniqueness because of our life situation in our past, and because of that and our conditioning, it's just as you said. There are some things in life that we show amazing understanding and patience for, and other things that just drive us crazy. And and that's, I think, across the board, whether it's patience or kindness or love or understanding. There are those areas in life, and again, I think especially, it's an ongoing process. So oftentimes, when we look back over our years of practice, we can see that there are, significant areas of life where a change has happened, and then we notice there are others where it hasn't, and that's good. Because again, I think as time goes on and we've been practicing a while, as we peel back the layers, things become clearer. And we realize there are some areas where the attachments or the conditionings or the woundings are fairly superficial or not too deep. And some areas where, it is. The conditioning has stuck in deeply, so that's good that you've noticed that, And you shouldn't be concerned or dismayed or anything, you know, what's wrong with my practice, because I think, again, a practice is an unfolding, and it unfolds in life, unfolds in reality. And so, therefore, we keep our practice alive by being very open to those places, and kind of not being excited, but you know, that's, I think, what keeps our practice interesting. That we, it's not a, you know, every day the same, every year the same. It's like we realize at certain times we really had to focus on this, and other times we had to really focus on that. Again, you know, Dharma practice, the teachings of the Buddha, if one has some intellectual capacity, are not that hard to understand intellectually. But it's in the application that we run into trouble. And so therefore, you know, that question that you raise is the right question, is, you know, you've identified, why is it in certain areas of my life, right, I demonstrate great patience, and other areas of my life or the situation or the people, I demonstrate great impatience. And again, I think if we are willing to turn our mindfulness, right, and concentration to that areas, I think we will see, you know, that there is something there. Because again, Shanti Deva says in the Path of the Bodhisattva, he says the antidote, and it's interesting, he calls impatience anger, which is interesting. And he says that the antidote to anger is understanding. We think the antidote to impatience is patience. But he says, no, the antidote to impatience, which is a form of anger, is understanding. And when there is understanding, then patience, right, which is a willingness to accept. Right? If we think about patience, what does that really mean? I mean, if it's kind of patience like a moral virtue, it is something that is kind of imposed. You know, something we force ourselves to do. I will be patient with this person. So that's from the outside, you know, kind of, you know, but we want it from, you know, in Dharma, we want it to really go from the inside, which is, again, for you to look deeply into the sources of your own impatience. And again, I think what you will find that whether it's a situation or an individual or whatever, there's a part of us that does not do the exercise of looking deeply and understanding. There's something that our conditioning holds us back from that, you know, because in a way we are funny, aren't we? You know what I'm saying? We are funny. I mean, it's almost, we do at a certain level know better, right? But at another level, we don't want to know better. At least in this situation, you know, we just want to let that old stuff just run riot. So I think that's good, you know. And again, the fact that you have seen that in certain areas or many areas of your life, you have learned to extend understanding and therefore be patient, should really let you know, oh, I do have the capacity. But what is it about this person, what is it about this situation that I don't want to do that? And in that case, we'll learn about ourselves. Because again, whether it's an historical situation, some, you know, some sort of living situation or a person, if we are willing to step into that situation or that person and see it from their side and understand, you know, like, you know, to me, they always, you know, it's Thich Nhat Hanh's, you know, poem, Call Me By My True Name, where he says, you know, I am the young boat woman raped by the pirates. but I am also that pirate, you know. Because if I had grown up on that island or whatever off of Thailand and had grown up into the pirate culture, and that's always what, I would be a pirate. You know, I would be doing what everybody else did because I wouldn't. So when I understand that, it's not that I condone what happened, you know, I don't hate the pirate, right? I understand that they are just the puppet of their own conditioning. They can't help acting the way they act because of their past, their conditioning. And therefore, again, patience doesn't mean I just put up with it, which we often think is patience. It means I really have deeply looked into this, and I understand. And even if I choose to act in a certain way, I don't do it from anger. I don't do it from hatred. I don't do it from impatience. You know, and that is that's a big mind, isn't it? It's a big heart and a big mind. But the Buddhist path calls us to having that kind of understanding. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if it was that kind of attitude in our political realm, right? Where people could have various point of views, but there wasn't this kind of hatred or disrespect or a judgment, you know, where we understand, yeah, well, I could understand, you know, the growing up the way they grew up and being in that kind of environment where that kind of way of thinking is taught all the time, right? That somebody would grow up believing that's true. You know, they haven't had the opportunities that I've had to see things differently. Right? They've never thought that things could be seen in a different way. You know, it's probably never even dawned on them. Right? And then you think about yourself, well, has that ever been that way with me? You know, have there been things that I believed in? You know, maybe there have been things that you know that you believed in or ways you were 10, 20 years ago that you look back and you go, wow. You know, I can't believe where I was at. You know, so you understand that even ourselves, you know, we have this capacity for narrowness, for one-sidedness. But yet we also, because of experiences, have the capacity to change. You know, that pirate who tacked that boat and raped that young girl, even though they did it from their conditioning, also has the potential for change if something changes, you know, and therefore that gives us a way of thinking about how, if we want to be of help to somebody, how we can maybe help them. Does that kind of deal with what you're... Yeah, so you're absolutely right. You do have the capacity of great patience. But again, it's when we're willing to really extend that willingness to really understand people from their side. To walk in their moccasins, as they say, and go, oh yeah, that's good. Thank you. Are there other questions? Really? Everybody's just great. So we can wrap this up early tonight, right? Well, just actually, somebody did email me something. They said, I love my family very much in a way that feels very natural and pure. But I, to be honest, I do not feel that same kind of love for others. Is this wrong? This is obviously somebody who is practicing Buddhism, Dharma, and has heard about what? That we are supposed to be what? loving people, right? We're supposed to be able to love everyone. But somebody says, but when I'm honest, this woman is saying, the love I have for my family is not like the love I have for others. Is this wrong? Am I too attached? What does Buddhism teach about this kind of love? So we have to be very careful. Again, that we have these generic teachings, let's say, about love in Buddhism, but they have to be applied because we are not abstract beings. Right? We are real beings living real lives. And so how we apply these teachings in an intelligent way is important. So one thing, of course, is to remember that when the Buddha or various teachers, teachings traditionally are always said to be given in a spirit of what's called upaya. You've heard me talk about upaya, many of you, upaya, which means skillful means, skillfulness. So teachings are not just given, you know, just like without any thought, without any intelligence, without any wisdom. They have to be appropriate to the person, they have to be appropriate to the situation, and they have to be given in a very way that really enables a person to utilize them. There has to be skill involved in applying these teachings. So I say that, an appropriateness to the person's situation, because when the Buddha or other teachers were addressing monastics, and when they were addressing lay people, they would give very different teachings. That is why you can read the same teachings with two different audiences and hear two very different versions, and you wonder what's going on here. But didn't the Buddha teach this over here and this over there? And, you know, and they think it's a contradiction. But it's not a contradiction if you understand upaya, appropriateness and skillfulness. So obviously, when you are talking to someone who has become a celibate monk or nun, who has taken a vow not to have intimate or particular relations at all, not to have possessions, not to have money, not to have really anything, but to devote themselves single-mindedly to not only to the practice, but to sharing it equally with everyone, you give one sort of teaching, right? That would be appropriate for them. But if you are talking to people who are lay people, which means they are in the world of relationship, right? Lay life is a life of relationships, and part of relationships is they become somewhat particularized, right? And so therefore, the issue is in the context of the lives of lay people, how does one live, right, these Buddhist teachings on love and loving kindness and compassion? And obviously, if one is living in a family situation, whether that's a small family that you're living with of some sort of another, or whether within your extended family and of some sort of another, you obviously have more closer, intimate, more ongoing relationships, right, than you have with people in the street. And you can't help but think, the more ongoing type of relationships with somebody, that you would become somewhat more involved just over time and space, and therefore there would be a higher degree of attachment than you would to complete strangers, right? I mean, that just makes sense. Right? I mean, for people to go, well, you know, I'm in an intimate relationship, I'm in a committed relationship, but I don't want to be attached at all. You know, my response is, but being in that kind of relationship already is about having some kind of attachment, right? Or you wouldn't be in a relationship, why go in a relationship? So already there's an attaching to. Now, I think the question is, and I think what this issue this woman raises is, is there a big space in between, you know, those that I love, my family and close friends, and everybody else, you know, and there's a wide variety of difference in the two, and there's no kind of connection, you know, and I think that's the problem. So when the Buddha taught about love, which is a word, which is an English word, the Buddha didn't teach anything called love, actually. He taught about metta, which is a kind of loving kindness, deep friendship. He taught about karuna, which is a compassionate involvement in awareness of somebody suffering and wanting to alleviate them. That he talked about taking joy in the joy of others, which means to not be jealous, but to be happy that other people are happy in the way they're happy. And he taught that there should be a quality of how this is dispensed. So it is in that context that he talked about love. And in that sense, we could say, that we all have the capacity of offering that to as many people as we can. Obviously, for us not to give special attention to those people we are closest with and spend most of our time with would be a little backwards, wouldn't it? I mean, obviously, those people that we are spending most of our time with, we should be offering more consistently on an ongoing basis our loving kindness, our friendship, our compassion, our happiness, our happiness for their joy and well-being, and you know, and all that stuff, right? I mean, so in that sense, we would think that those we are closest to would be more the recipients of our love, but there shouldn't be this exclusivity. There shouldn't be this difference, because again, we know that even though it sounds good, we know that many people find that it is those people that they are closest with that they often have the most difficulty being consistently loving, which is an interesting experience. And so therefore, we could say that it is with those we are closest with, live in most close intimacy with or work with, that our capacity to love in a certain way, it's sort of the opposite of this, what this woman said. In a certain way, our capacity to love is most tested, and there are many people who find it easier to be loving to people when they don't know them. You know, when they're at a distance. Yeah, well, then, very easy to be kind to people who don't push our buttons. You know what I'm saying? So, attachment. See, attachment, it doesn't mean, one can love somebody, which means one can offer someone deep friendship, one can really care about another human being, one can be very supportive of another human being, one can be very helpful to another human being, one can be very happy when one is in the presence of another human being. And then the question is, Can you do that without attachment, right? And attachment in Buddhism is not like a big no-no, you know? It's not like a moral fault, right? That you have to watch out for, like it's a sin. Attachment is cautioned against because it is a source of suffering. It is a source of suffering. It will take that heart that has the capacity for offering friendship and love and support and kindness to that other person. And because of attachment, because of wanting to hold on, because of wanting to attach and turn that into something to meet my needs, that actually one's capacity for love is twisted, is contaminated. Right? So attachment actually is an impediment to love. Because that kind of love that is attached is a love that wants to control and manipulate, which isn't love. Because when you really love somebody, you want them to be happy within their own right. You know what I'm saying? It's not that we want them to be happy the way I want them to be happy, because they're doing all the things that make me happy. Right? That's not love, is it? That's control and manipulation that comes from ego, that comes from self. So that is, to my way of thinking, and I think Buddhism supports that, that the practice of non-self is the practice of love. That is the manifestation of love, that when one has a deep understanding of non-self, the non-self nature of who and what we are and everyone else, then one has the capacity, because everyone one encounters is no longer an object of the self, is no longer an object for the self to meet its needs, but it's a being that is freely encountered just as they are, and one's heart naturally is capable of offering freely friendship, kindness, support, caring, compassion. Right? So, yeah, so again, in terms of love, this person said, well, what does Buddhism say about this kind of love? I think she's talking about this love like she has for her family. If it's a love that is attached and it's based on a holding and a grasping, and it is that kind of love in Buddhism, again, is seen as not pure love, but as a source of suffering. Because when you love somebody in that very attached and grasping way, when it's not working the way we want, we get what? We get angry. What?
Upset.
We get upset. We get angry. We get resentful. We get hurt. We get disappointed. We get sad. We get, right? So those are all called afflictive emotions. And they are arising because what we think we are doing as love, we are really doing in the service of self and its needs. So therefore, attachment, you'll always know whether you're attached, because you will feel that grasping and that holding and that need to manipulate and control. It doesn't mean that kind of love won't give you some degree of happiness. It will when it's all going your way. And then you'll feel really great. But don't worry, it will change. And you'll know it on the other side, because when it starts going the other way, you will again find yourself upset, angry, sad, resentful, hurt, and all that stuff. And that should be a sign, because I think when we are in a relationship where there's really this kind of pure open love, there's no suffering. Okay. I don't know, maybe you disagree with me. How do you see love in terms of a path? Yes.
I see what she's talking about. In two different ways. I see the love that you have for your family, and like you said, you obviously have more of a deep relationship with those that you spend a lot of time with. And she asked if it was wrong if she doesn't feel the same sort of love for other people. But I see the love that Buddhism talks about that we should have for other people a little differently. It's sort of an understanding and a recognition that we are a part of a whole. That, like you said, that there's no self really in me, there's no self in you, that we are all together and one. And so I love you as I would love myself, mm-hmm. because we're the same. We're just parts of one big human family, I see that type of love is more of an understanding and a recognition and a respect, I guess. And yeah, it seems different than the love that I would have for my family, but I think that the same sort of, there's a similarity that runs mm-hmm. through all of it.
Yeah, so Whitney's just been talking a little bit about her own experience of what it means to love others in one's own family. I'm just repeating for them, and how it really stems from this lack of self and therefore lack of connection and interconnection. We're all part of a whole, and so therefore we recognize a sameness in each other. Right, so therefore my suffering is your suffering, my needs are your needs, and my happiness is, right, and that's, there's no self in that. So that is why, you know, when there's self in it, and Whitney tells me she won the lottery, you know, my response would be, how come I didn't win the lottery? I mean, that's not fair, right? I mean, you see, because right away my reference point is what? Me. And I only care about what? My own well-being. Because there is that separation, right? But when there's no separation, and Whitney tells me about a good fortune, that you're, you know, naturally happy. How wonderful. How wonderful. Because there's no self-reference. And that is, you know, and that is very important. You know, it's interesting that this person talks about her family and children. You know, in Buddhism, when we talk about compassion, it is often said, you know, like, well, traditionally, like a mother has for a child, a parent has for a child, that that's the model. You see, that's, I think the another aspect of this is in these perhaps areas of life where a love comes naturally in this way, right? One actually then learns about the capacity, the natural spontaneous capacity of the human heart mind to love. Hmm? Because, again, sticking with mothers for a while, we know that mothers, let's say, it doesn't matter where in the world, whatever the culture is, it doesn't matter, rich, poor, ethnicity, whatever, We know all, in most cases, unless there's been significant damage to that mother in some kind of emotional way, that most mothers have an immediate capacity to what?
Love.
To love their infant, right? And it's not something they have to go to school for or be educated about. It's a natural wanting to hold and to protect and to take care of and to nurture and to put their needs ahead of your own, right? I mean, if somebody says to a three-year-old, if a parent says to a three-year-old, knock it off, you know, I mean, I need my sleep, you know, I'm just going to put you in the closet, let you cry for a while. We call that what?
Neglect.
Neglect or abuse. Because we acknowledge that the natural response is to naturally want to remediate the suffering of that infant, even if it makes me uncomfortable. Right? It's not something we have to think about. In the same way, again, if we have a good friend, somebody we love, and they're in need, we will what? We will be there for them. Even if we're tired, even if we're, you know what I mean? We will be, even if we have other plans, we'll break them because we care. And hopefully it's not something we have to be thinking about. It's, oh, of course I'll do that. Oh, no problem, right? Of course I'll do that. So that shows that we have this capacity of responsiveness with beings and that it is natural. But in many of us, it stopped. It has barriers and limits. And so therefore, using our experience where it has been natural, we know that we have that capacity, and then through these practices, it's a matter of just taking down the barriers. The barriers that really aren't there. They only exist in our minds. They exist as, you know, thoughts, beliefs. You know, people say, oh, I can't do that. My heart can only open so much. You know, people talk this way. As if like a human heart is like that and only has a certain... I mean, hearts aren't like that, are they? No, they don't go like that. That's just something the mind imposes. Right? So, you know. The idea of having a limitless heart, which means a heart that has the capacity of offering loving kindness, friendship, and compassion to everyone is certainly possible. Right? It doesn't mean we have the capacity of interacting with everybody, but certainly we have the capacity in our minds to be that vast. In our metta, in our loving kindness meditations, we wish for the well-being of everyone. Right? May all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering. Right? May all beings be free from violence and war and hunger. So we have the capacity in our minds to generate a type of wish that embraces everyone. And, I mean, is there any reason that we can't greet every human being that we run into as a friend? No. Yes, Anna.
As we were speaking, I'm thinking about this idea of mother and love. You know, but I heard that mothers is a mother of a child. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the ideal of unconditional love.
Right.
But it does seem to me like actually that's a very difficult role for humans to. I think the mother loves the child because she sees it as herself. And as the child becomes more, you know, looks like it's not herself anymore, I think that that could be need to grasp and attach. That was one thing I was thinking.
No, but let me just, okay, go on.
I think some mothers are able to do that.
Mm-hmm. A lot what?
A lot of them aren't able to. Lots of times, you know, they can love a child when they think it's them, but they don't, they see that just this child is them, not everybody is them.
Right, so...
This child is me, but not you.
Right, but that is, we could say that journey, the question is, you know, sounds good ideally, and oftentimes mothers early on have this very open love for the child, because the child is not seen as different than themselves, but over time that begins to separate, and the child is begin to seen as separate from oneself, and so therefore the mother's relationship with that child cannot be as totally 100% unconditional as it was. And you're right, and that is the journey also for the child. And that is a journey, fortunately or unfortunately, that most human beings in this life are making, where they have lost that capacity to see themselves in others and others in themselves without separation. And again, what you're talking about, that early on experience of oneness, again, should be a reminder that it is there. It does not have to be manufactured. But why doesn't it continue? And the answer, you answered it, which is because we separate. And we see the other as an object different than ourselves, and we see the other as an object not only different than themselves, but there to fulfill our needs and wants. And from that, you know, all hell breaks loose. On all sides. And in a certain way, I think the reason in the Buddhist texts on love, they talk about a mother's love for children as kind of an archetype, is because it is that, it is a love that is pure and is selfless, right? I mean, the loving parent will do anything for the well-being of that child, won't they? They will even say things like, if their child was deathly ill or something, they'd say, what? I'd rather be me. I mean, that's quite something, isn't it? To say things like that. That shows you the capacity that we all have, that we can acknowledge someone else's suffering and be willing to take it on for ourselves. But, you know, there are people who do that. Huh? I mean, there are firemen who go into burning houses to rescue people. Huh? I mean, every day there are incidences of people willing to put themselves in harm's way to protect others or to take care of others. So it's not that foreign. Again, but in the realm we're talking, it is something to be cultivated. But to know that that is where we began. It's not like we have this far journey back to a land, you know, of that is unknown to us. No, we all know that place. Again, depending on our upbringing and childhood, whether that was nurtured, or whether that are very early on got a little contaminated, a little thwarted, maybe even shut down. That's the causes and conditions of our lives. But that doesn't mean that that essential capacity is not still alive and can be touched and awakened. and live from. Definitely. Good. Wow. Any last minute questions about the Buddha's teachings on love? Yes.
One of the better things about aging.
One of the better things about aging. Good.
Is that one finally learns to love more unconditionally everyone. Mm-hmm. Because it's not, you start to see that it's not about the body, it's not about the perfect romance, but that it's about perfect friendship.
What?
It seems like mostly you can get that only when you're aged.
Well, you can either, yeah, so the... So Anna's talking about there's a lot of learning that goes on just from aging, from having experience and having done it this way and that way and kind of gotten beaten up by life a bit, that one kind of at the end comes to a place where one knows about giving up a lot of things that get in the way of the capacity of love. And I agree with you. I mean, I think there hopefully there can be a kind of wising up that comes naturally from experience over time. But again, I think that's also why we follow a spiritual path, because a lot of that kind of trial and error stuff can be short-circuited when we learn from the experience of others. But I think they're probably both true, and certainly you know, reinforce each other. Yeah. Good. So it is 8:30, so why don't we stop here? Thank you.